Sharpness which I may possess has been entirely gained by the admirable foil which you've made for me. Have I not heard of debutantes who insist upon plainness in their chaperones?
As I was about to say, I may be very obtuse, but I'm unable to see how you know about the university's request, given that the letter has only just arrived, and I haven't spoken to you since.
In spite of that, I would even venture to suggest that the object of the bazaar is to enlarge the university cricket field. Really, I find the range of correspondence delivered to 221B a constant source of delight. I myself have received a rather curious appeal for assistance from a Mrs. Merrillow of South Brixton. She says she will call that... good fellow unanswered, will you, Watson? I fear Mrs. Hudson's rheumatism has been playing her up of late.
And I wish to God I had not.
It was terribly mutilated.
Well, Mr. Holmes, you'd hardly say it was a face at all. And that's how it looked. Our milkman once got a glimpse of her peeping out of the upper window, and he dropped the milk all over the front garden. That's the kind of face it is.
Do you know anything of her history?
Nothing at all.
Did she give references when she came?
No, sir, but she gave hard cash and plenty of it. A quarter's rent right down on the table in advance, and no arguing about terms. In these times, a poor woman like me can't afford to turn down an offer like that.
Did she give you any reason for choosing your house?
Mine stands well back from the road. It's more private than most. I only take the one lodger, and I have no family of my own. I reckon that she had tried others and found that mine suited her best. It's privacy she's after, and she's ready to pay for it.
You say that she has never shown her face from first to last, save on the one accidental occasion. Well, it all sounds very remarkable, Mrs. Merrillow. I don't wonder that you wanted examined.
I don't, Doctor. I'm quite satisfied as so long as I get my rent. You couldn't have a quieter lodger, or one who gives less trouble.
Then what has brought matters to her head?
Her health, Mr. Holmes. She seems to be wasting away, and there's something terrible on her mind.
These cries of murder in her sleep.
Yes, sir. And once, you cruel beast, you monster. It fair rang through the house and sent the shivers through me. The next morning, I spoke to her. Mrs. Rhonda, if you have anything that's troubling your soul, there's the clergy and the police. Between them, you should get some help.
For God's sake, not the police. And the clergy can't change what's past. And yet, it would ease my mind if someone knew the truth before I died.
Well, if you won't have the regulars, there's this detective man you're always reading about. If he's real, I mean.
Sherlock Holmes. Yes, of course. I wonder I never thought of it before. Bring him here, Mrs. Merrillo, bring him. And if he won't come, tell him I'm the wife of Rhonda's wild beast show. Say that and give him the name Abbas Carver. That will bring him as a man of thinking.
And it will. Watson, your presence may be useful.
Of course, Holmes. Anything I can do.
You will understand, Mrs. Merrillo, that if I see Mrs. Rhonda, I should prefer to have a witness. Please make that clear to her before we arrive.
Lord bless you, Mr. Holmes. She's that anxious to see you that you might bring the whole parish at your heels.
Then we shall come early in the afternoon. I should like to have a little chat with Dr. Watson. That will carry us to lunchtime. About 3 o'clock you may expect to see us at your house in Brixton. Watson, please show Mrs. Merrillo out.
Please follow me, Mrs. Merrillo.
Oh, thank you, Doctor. So nice to meet a real gentleman.
Where did I keep a record?
Abbas Parva. Somewhere in Berkshire, isn't it, Holmes?
You have no recollection of the case?
None whatsoever.
I was certain you were with me back then. It was 7 years ago, I believe. The case worried me at the time, though, and here are my notes to prove it. Perhaps you would care to read them.
If it's all the same with you, I'd sooner hear your own recollection of the case.
It's all the same to me, old chap, but I'm afraid my own impression was very superficial. There was nothing to go on, and none of the parties had engaged my services. And yet I was convinced that the coroner was wrong. And Edmonds of the Berkshire Constabulary agreed with me. A smart lad, that. He was sent later to Allahabad, you know.
Edmonds? A thin yellow-haired man?
Exactly. I was sure we'd pick up the trail presently.
Thank you, Holmes. Now, from the beginning, please.
My apologies, Watson. Very well. Rhonda, of course, was a household word then, the rival of Womwell and Sanger. See, here's a photograph.
A huge porcine gentleman.
Your restraint does you credit, Doctor.
And do I take it that this very magnificent woman is his wife?
Correct. Rhonda was one of the greatest showmen of his day. There is evidence, however, that he took to drink, and that both he and his show were on the downgrade at the time of the great tragedy.
Tragedy?
Right here, Mr. Holmes, the caravan had halted for the night. I know it's too long for there still to be any clues, but I'd thought you'd want to see.
Thank you, Edmonds. Please continue.
Well, they're on their way to Wimbledon, travelling by road, and they were simply camping and not exhibiting. Abbas Parvar, so small it wouldn't have paid them to open. They had among their exhibits a very fine North African lion named Sahara King. It was the habit, both of Rhonda and his wife, to give exhibitions inside its cage.
Dangerous habit.
Indeed. It was deposed at the inquest that there'd been some signs that the lion was dangerous. But as usual, familiarity begat contempt, and no note was taken of the fact. You see, it was usual for either Rhonda or his wife to feed the lion at night.
No one else?
No one, Mr. Holmes. Sometimes one went, sometimes both, but they never allowed anyone else to do it. They believed so long as they were the food carriers, the beasts would regard them as benefactors and would never molest them.
And on the night in question?
They both went. The cage would have been about here. Near midnight, the whole camp was roused by a woman's scream, mingled with the sound of a man shouting in terror. The different grooms and employees rushed from their tents, carrying lanterns, and discovered Rhonda, with the back of his head crushed in, and deep claw marks across his scalp.
Where did he lie? Be as precise as you can, Edmonds.
Well, some 10 yards from the cage. Here, if memory serves.
And the cage door was open?
It was. Close to the door lay Mrs. Rhonda upon her back, with the lion squatting and snarling above her. It had torn her face in such a fashion it was never thought she'd live. Leonardo the strong man and Griggs the clown drove the creature back into the cage. How it got loose in the first place is a mystery. It was conjectured that the pair intended to enter the cage, but that when the door was opened it bounded out upon them.
And there was no other point of interest in the evidence?
None, Mr. Holmes, save that the woman in a delirium of agony kept screaming, "Coward, coward," as she was carried back to the van in which they lived. It was 6 months before she was fit to give evidence, but the inquest was duly held with the obvious verdict of death from misadventure.
Obvious. Quite.
You'll appreciate it was very difficult for anyone to reconstruct the affair. You have other ideas, I suppose, sir.
I take it that the jury failed to look at the situation from the lion's point of view.
The lion's point of view, sir?
Naturally, Edmunds. He is liberated. What does he do? He takes half a dozen bounds forward, which brings him to Rhonda.
Rhonda turns to fly, but the creature strikes him down. The claw marks were on the back of the head.
Then, instead of bounding on and escaping, he returns to the woman who is close to the cage, and he knocks her over and chews her face up. And those cries of hers would seem to imply that her husband had in some way failed her. What could the poor devil have done to help her with his head crushed in? You see the difficulty.
You think there was another man there?
I think there was another man there. The camp was awoken by the sounds of a man shouting in terror, was it not?
Well, Rhonda, presumably.
But you said that those cries were mingled with the woman's screams. Well, if Rhonda's skull was smashed in, you would hardly expect to hear from him again, would you?
You know, I'd always thought there was something funny there, but I could never put my finger on it. But if you'll forgive me for saying so, Mr. Holmes, I should think the whole camp was crying out by then. As to the other points, I could suggest a solution.
Please do, sir. I should be glad to consider it.
Mr. and Mrs. Rhonda were together 10 yards from the cage when the lion got loose. The man turned and was struck down. The woman conceived the idea of getting into the cage and shutting the door behind her. But just as she reached it, the beast bounded after her and knocked her over. And she was angry with her husband for having encouraged the beast's rage by turning, hence her cries of coward.
Excellent, Edmunds. There is only one flaw in your diamond.
And what's that flaw, Mr. Holmes?
If they were both 10 paces from the cage, how did the beast get loose?
I suppose... Never mind.
Please, Watson, I am all attention.
Well, is it possible that Rhonda had some enemy who loosed it?
It was certainly possible, Watson. He was a huge bully of a man who cursed and slashed at everyone who came in his way.
I expect those cries about a monster are his wife's nocturnal reminiscences of the dear departed.
Possibly. Possibly. But my investigations turned up no such enemy who had been in or near Abbas Parva that night. And in any case, why should the lion attack its owners when it was in the habit of playing with them and doing tricks with them inside the cave?
And perhaps that same enemy, whoever it was, had done something to enrage it.
A reasonable assumption. However, our speculations are futile until we have all the facts. There is a cold partridge on the sideboard, Watson, a bottle of Montrachet. Let us renew our energies before we pay a visit to Mrs. Rhonda.
Mrs. Merrill. I learned it when I'd recovered my health and was examined by Mr. Edwards, the counterintelligence. Perhaps it would have been wiser if I told the truth. If the fate of someone else depended upon it, I know that he was a very worthless being, and yet I would not have his destruction upon my conscience. We had been so close. Yes, Doctor. The person I allude to is dead.
Why should we not now tell the police?
Because there is another. I could not stand the scandal and publicity which would come from the police examination. I have not long to live, but I wish to die undisturbed. And yet, I wanted to find men of judgment to whom I could tell my story, so that when I'm gone, all might be understood.
the same time, I am a responsible person. I cannot promise to have spoken, but I may not think it my duty to confirm.
I think not, Mr. Holmes. I know your character and methods too well, for I have followed your work for some years. Reading is the only pleasure which fate has left me, and I miss nothing which passes in the world. You see my little library? I will take my chance of the use which you may make of my tragedy. It will ease my mind to tell it. Mr. Holmes, would you be so good as to pass this paper to Dr. Watson? I should very much like to hear your description of it based upon that photograph, Doctor. I am well aware of Mr. Holmes's amazing powers, but I am also aware of your remarkable gift for perception. As a writer, I wish to hear your frank assessment of my husband's character. I have never had guests before, but how fortunate I am to have both a great mind in Mr. Holmes and a great heart in Dr. Watson here in my own little room.
Now perhaps you would enlighten us.
These two pictures will help you to understand the story, gentlemen. I was a poor circus girl, brought up on the sawdust and doing springs through the hoop before I was 10. When I became a woman, this man wrongly loved me. If such lust as his can be called love. And in an evil moment I became his wife. From that day I was in hell, and he the devil who tormented me. There was no one in the show who did not know of his treatment. He deserted me for others. He tied me down and lashed me with his riding whip when I complained. They all pitied me, and they all loathed him, but what could they do? They feared him one and all, for he was terrible at all times and murderous when he was drunk. Again and again he was charged with assault and cruelty to the beasts, but he had plenty of money, and the fines were nothing to him. The best men were leprous, and the show began to go downhill. It was only Leonardo and I who kept him. He pitied me and helped me till at last our intimacy turned into a deep, passionate love. Such love as I had dreamed of but never hoped to feel. My husband suspected it, but he was a coward as well as a woman. And Leonardo was the one man he was afraid of. He took revenge in his own way by torturing me more than ever. Very soon my lover and I understood that it could not be avoided. My husband was not fit to live. We planned that he should die. Leonardo came up with the plan. I don't say that to blame him, for I was ready to go with him every inch of the way. But I should never have had the wit to think of such a thing. He made a club, and in the leaden head he fastened five long steel nails, the points outward, with just such a spread as the lion's paw. This was to give my husband his death blow, and yet to leave the evidence that it was the lion, Sahara King, who had done the deed. Oh, he had a clever, scheming brain. I know now what a poor spirit was hidden in that splendid body. But compared to my husband, he seemed like the angel Gabriel. It was a pitch dark night, and my husband and I went down to feed the beast as was our custom. We carried with us the raw meat in a zinc pail. Leonardo was waiting in the corner of a big van which we should have to pass before we reached the cage. He was too slow, and we walked past him before he could strike, but he followed us on tiptoe, and I heard the crash as the club smashed my husband's skull. I sprang forward, and I undid the latch which held the door of the lion's cage, and then a terrible thing happened. You may have heard how quickly his creature creatures are to scent human blood and how it excites them. Some strange instinct had told Sahara King that a human being had been slain. As I slipped the bars, it bounded out and was on me in an instant.
Oh my God!
Oh! Oh! When I saw him turn, the lion met in my face. The filthy breath had already poisoned me, and I was hardly conscious of pain. With the palms of my hands, I tried to push the steaming blood-stained jaws away from me, and I screamed for help. I was conscious that the camp was stirring, and then, dimly, I remembered a group of men dragging me from under the creature's paws. My last memory, gentlemen, of many weary months. When I came to myself, I saw myself in the mirror, cursed that lion. Oh, how I cursed him. Not because he had torn away my beauty, but because he had not torn away my life. I never saw him or heard from him again. Perhaps I've been wrong to feel so bitterly against him. I might have seen the blood on the creeks when we carried round the country as the thing which the lion had left. But a woman's love is not so easily set aside. He left me under the beast's claws. He deserted me in my moment of need, and yet I could not bring myself to give him to the gallows. By none, and that I should dwell where none whom I have ever known should find me. That is all that was left for me to do, and that is what I have done. A poor wounded beast that has crawled into its hole to die. That is the end of Eugenia.
Your life is not your own.
What use is it to anyone?
The example of patient suffering is in itself
I wonder if you.
Can't remember them now, thank heavens.
Help yourself to some breakfast. The kippers may be a little cold, I'm afraid.
Oh, thank you. What are you reading, Holmes?
A very interesting article upon the trees of Cremona and the exact reasons for their preeminence in the manufacture of violins. It's one of those small outlying problems to which I'm sometimes tempted to direct my attention. Have you given any more thought to the request for assistance from your old university?
Yes. Mostly, how you were able to deduce the content of my letter without even seeing it.
No magic, Watson. The fact is that you're an excellent subject for observation. You are never blasé. You respond instantly to any external stimulus. Your mental processes may be slow, but they are never obscure. And I found during breakfast yesterday that you were easier reading than the leader in the Times in front of me.
Nevertheless, I'd be glad to know how you arrived at your conclusions.
Fear my good nature in giving explanations has seriously compromised my reputation. But in this case, the train of reasoning is based upon such obvious facts that no credit can be claimed for it. You entered the room with a thoughtful expression, the expression of a man who is debating some point in his mind. In your hand, you held a solitary letter. Now, the previous night you retired in the best of spirits, so it was clear that it was this letter which had caused the change in you.
Obviously.
It's all obvious when it's explained, old chap. I naturally asked myself what the letter could contain which might have this effect upon you. As you walked, you held the flat side of the envelope towards me, and I saw upon it the same shield-shaped device which I've observed upon your old college cricket cap. It was clear, then, that the request came from Edinburgh University, or from some club connected with the university. When you reached the table, you laid down the letter beside your plate with the address uppermost, and you walked over to look at the framed photograph upon the left of the mantelpiece.
What next?
I began by glancing at the address, and I could tell, even at the distance of 6 feet, that it was an unofficial communication. Now, this I gathered from the use of the word doctor upon the address, to which, as a Bachelor of Medicine, you have no legal claim. University officials are pedantic in their correct use of titles. Yes, what is it?
In the year 1878, Holmes, I took the degree of Doctor of Medicine of the University of London. I mention this in case you had forgotten.
My apologies, old fellow. I had forgotten.
Yes, well. I may have neglected to inform the authorities at Edinburgh. Do continue, Holmes.
Thank you. Had it been an official letter, it would have been addressed to John H. Watson, M.D., rather than to Dr. Watson. Now, when, on your return to the table, you turned over your letter and allowed me to perceive that the enclosure was a printed one, the idea of a bazaar first occurred to me.
It might have been a political communication.
Improbable, in the present stagnant condition of politics. When you returned to the table, your face still retained its expression, and it was evident that your examination of the photograph had not changed the current of your thoughts. In that case, it must itself bear upon the subject in question. I turned my attention to the photograph, therefore, and saw at once that it consisted of yourself as a member of the Edinburgh University 11, with the pavilion and the cricket field in the background. My small experience of cricket clubs has taught me that, next to churches and cavalry ensigns, they're the most debt-laden things upon earth. When, upon your return to the table, I saw you take out your pencil and draw lines upon the envelope, I was convinced that you were endeavouring to realise some projected improvement, which was to be brought about by a bazaar.
Of course. As it happens, I've been asked to contribute something to their album.
As a respected literary figure and a celebrity in your own right, I should expect nothing less.
My only problem now is what I should write for them. The giant rat of Sumatra, perhaps? Or the repulsive story of the Red Leech? The affair of the Amateur Mendicant Society was without its points of interest, I suppose.
You surprise me, Watson.
It's good to know that I possess that ability. Why do I surprise you?
I should have thought you would have set down the details of our recent excursion to South Brixton.
It's clear you don't know anything about literature, Holmes. The general public would never accept the story of the Veiled Lodger.
Good title.
Yes, I thought so. No, the matter is inconclusive. There's no dramatic resolution. The audience would feel let down.
Funny you should say that, Watson. This arrived in the Morning Post.
A bottle?
Sniff the content.
Almond odour. Prussic acid. Who on earth sent you this?
This brief note accompanied the package.
I send you my temptation. I will follow your advice.
I think, Watson, we can guess the name of the brave woman who sent it.
It seems she was mistaken when she thought you were a great mind without a great heart.
If I possess that quality to any degree, I owe it to you, Doctor.
No, no, my dear fellow. I won't hear of it, but thank you, in any case.
Poor woman.
Yes, poor woman indeed.
The ways of fate are indeed hard to understand. If there is not some compensation hereafter, then the world is a cold guest.
You have been listening to The Veiled Lodger by Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, dramatised the radio by M.J. Elliott. You heard Jim Crozier as Sherlock Holmes and Dave Hawkes as Dr. Watson, with Beth Walters as Virginia Rondo. Mrs. Merrillow was played by Angie Budd, and Inspector Edmonds by Jason Powers. The announcer was Angie Budd. The play was directed by Roger Johnson and produced by Dennis Rickard for Hossenbrock Productions.